Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Look, there's only one party that has the possibility of saving humanity here. It's the Democratic Party. And it would be a good thing to brand our party as the party who cares about this.
It's so sad that that is like a not hyperbolic statement.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. Well, here I am with doing an intro because the feedback from last episode was very pro-intro. So here we go. Back at it. Back in 2004, before I was a full-time writer, I was 25 years old, and I was very invested in the election that year, which was George W. Bush running for re-election against John Kerry. And so I took 2 months, almost 3 months, and I went to work for the League of Conservation Voters, which was operating a field program in Dane County, which is the county around Madison, Wisconsin. Madison, obviously, a very liberal place, but the suburbs around it are sort of swingier. And I was knocking on doors there, trying to persuade persuadable voters to vote for John Kerry and not George W. Bush. And when I was done with that endeavor, I wrote an article for the New Republic, which we'll link to on the website, still up there on the internet, which was about some of the things I learned while I was talking to undecided voters. And one of the things that was really interesting to me was that they didn't have a very crystal clear concept of issues and what an issue was. And it was striking to me, like, if you're a political junkie and someone said to you, like, what are the big issues? And you could very obviously label them. Like, there are categories of things, like immigration is an issue. Healthcare is an issue. Trade with China is an issue, right? And you could even get more kind of like bespoke in issues, like land use policy is an issue. But you have a sense of like the category as a coherent entity. But when you think about it, it's kind of a weird alchemical process that produces an issue as a coherent category. If you go back and you look at American politics, there's different periods of time where things are issues that to us are like make no sense. Like, there was 60 years in American politics where like alcohol prohibition and alcohol intemperance were a main issue, like huge issue that people fought over. And, you know, that's not an issue anymore. We got that issue was resolved essentially. And then there's times when like things become really big issues and then fade, like the Panama Canal and who controls the Panama Canal was like a very big issue at a certain point. It was an issue that people got like worked up about. They would like rant about, which now seems a little ridiculous. Like most of us can't recall, like, what were they fighting about with the Panama? There was something back in the day. So there's this very interesting thing that happens that I'm very interested in is how does an issue get formed as an issue? A big part of politics, even before you can win an issue, is to make something an issue, right? Before you can win an issue, you have to create the coherent political category of the issue. Like 10 years ago, there was no issue of cash bail. Cash bail was not an issue. It was just the way a court worked. Like you got arraigned, you got indicted, and then you had cash bail. And if you didn't have the money, you went to Rikers. Now cash bail is an issue. Should we get rid of cash bail? And the reason cash bail is an issue is because organizers work to make it an issue. So now there's a fight. You have to have a policy, right? If you're running for district attorney, particularly if you have got a progressive challenger, you're going to debate and you're going to have a position on whether you favor doing away with cash bail or not. So there's this remarkable alchemical process that's like, it's like if you think of a snow-capped mountain, like the snow at the top are the issues that we all know. And then underneath it is the mountain, which is like all of human life and society and all the frictions that involves. And we kind of like the stuff at the top is just like a little small part of what our full political life is. But it's the job of organizers to like bring that into focus. And I think about this a lot with respect to climate. Climate is now an issue. Like if you run for president as a Democratic candidate and you say to someone, build my website, right? And they say, I'll build your website. There's an issues tab. And then there's going to be a drop down menu. Like, there's got to be a climate portion. That's how you know, right? Like when you're making the issues menu on the website. And that's been the work of a lot of activists, right? So there's immigration, healthcare, climate. And one of the things we're seeing is climate is moving up the priority list. When you ask Democratic voters what issues matter most, them climate's at the top. But there's a question of whether that's enough. Because climate, arguably isn't like any other issue. David Wallace Wells on this podcast, when we talked about his book about the sort of future of the climate, said the climate is like modernity. It's the thing that we all exist in. Modernity isn't an issue. I mean, it has manifestations, right? Like, there are political fights over the manifestations of modernity or the Industrial Revolution and urbanization and the labor condition that created, but it's everything. And climate is almost definitionally everything. Everything that we do, you right now, listener, hearing me in your ear holes, like, you and I are both existing in the climate as a definitional matter. If the climate is in crisis, there is an argument that that is the or issue. That it doesn't, it just doesn't fit comfortably in that menu on the website in the same way that other things do, like the minimum wage, how many refugees we should let in, right? There's a case to be made that just in a conceptual sense, the climate is something bigger. The climate crisis is something bigger than an issue. And that is the conceit of the campaign of my guest today. Jay Inslee is a Democratic governor of the state of Washington. He was a former congressman. He's a really interesting guy, and he's running for president. It's the first time we've had a presidential candidate on the podcast. And he's running an interesting, strange, and different campaign. He is running a campaign whose fundamental organizing premise is that the climate crisis is more important than anything else, that the climate crisis is everything, that the reason he's running for president is to confront the climate crisis. He is a climate candidate. And what's fascinating to me about that is two things. One, it's a totally different way to run for president. But it also is the first time I've heard a politician really talk about climate at this existential level in the way that David Wallace Wells does, right? That, like, this is the totalizing challenge. And so I'm not necessarily someone who, like, on the podcast, you know, I get to talk to the Democratic candidates all the time on the show. Necessarily want to sit down with all of them. But because of that, because of the distinctness of what Jay Inslee is trying to do, and because of my own belief that he's correct in one key way, which is that it is the case, the climate is the all-enveloping issue of our time, I wanted to sit down with him for an hour and just have him explain to me how he thinks about what he's doing in running for president as the climate candidate.
Where did you grow up?
Seattle, Washington. My dad was a coach and biology teacher. My mom was a retail clerk, and they spent summers fixing the Mount Rainier Alpine Meadows.
And were you a high school football player?
I was a high school quarterback. My defensive coach said that was not really a football position. He never considered quarterbacks a real football player, but I enjoyed playing the game.
And then you were a college player, right?
I played freshman basketball at Stanford.
You never played on the team there.
I played football. No. Right, yeah, I watched Jim Plunkett and my college freshman roommate, who was the number one recruit that year in America, Jim Wise. I watched his ascension, and I went out and played catch with him the first day I was at Stanford. And I noticed that I could throw it maybe 40 yards, and he could throw it 60 yards on a frozen rope. So I recognized his talent.
Yeah, right. What sort of got you into politics?
I was practicing law, raising three kids in the apple orchards in a small town in eastern Washington, agricultural Republican district. And they were going to start having to double shift our high school. And Trudy and I thought that was nuts.
What do you mean double shift?
Meaning you'd have to have two shifts in your high school because there wasn't room for everybody in the high school.
Ah, I see. So the high school was overcrowded.
High school was
grossly
overcrowded.
Rather than build a new building.
So instead of building a new building, they were going to start double shifting. And I said, well, this is crazy. Why don't we build a new high school? And the community said, because we have failed six bond issues in a row. And Trudy and I were naive.
So six times they had tried to,
six times.
To pass a bond issue.
Correct.
That would have given the capital to build a new school.
Correct.
And six times the taxpayers, your neighbors, had been like, no way.
That's correct. So Trudy and I were new to town. We were politically naive. And we said, well, let's give it a seventh try. So another couple and I, and we co-chaired the effort. And we passed it on the seventh try. And the way we did it, I thought, was kind of genius, because we ran ads showing blackness on the screen, and you can hear somebody snoring, And then you would hear an alarm bell go off, and you'd hear this guy griping, what's 3 o'clock? What are we doing? And then you hear the wife's voice as the light went on. Well, Harvey, you should have voted for the CELA school bond, and we wouldn't have had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. So we passed
that's
it on
a pretty good, that as a parent of three kids, that's a pretty good argument.
So we passed it on the seventh try, and shortly thereafter, the chowderheads in the legislature cut the funding in half. So all of a sudden, we didn't have enough money to build a school. So I became angry about it. I started to go raise holy hell about it, and then decided I should run for the legislature. And that's what I did, and won in a huge upset. And here we are.
How old were you?
I was about 38, and I've never thought about politics before. And it was like a lot of people, my entry into public life was a response to something that I was angry about. I didn't think it was just that our community had passed this school bond, and then all of a sudden we get cut half from the state funding. So I have been at school funding for a long time, and I'm still at it. I'm very pleased in the last session of my legislature. We just passed one of the largest infusions of money into our school system in the state history, and we did it on a bipartisan basis. We also passed, finally, the largest teacher and educator compensation increase in America this year, which I'm very pleased about. So this has been a long time passion of mine.
I want to just go back for 1 second, which is you grew up in Seattle, you went to Stanford. For folks that don't know the state of Washington, Eastern Washington and the sort of Seattle, Western Washington area and the Eastern Washington are pretty different places in terrain, in culture and in politics. Certainly Eastern Washington, which is adjacent to Idaho, is a very rural conservative place. What brought you out there?
Well, let's see. I sort of went broke at Stanford, went back to the University of Washington, and then went to law school in Oregon. And my wife and I wanted to raise our children in a small town. We wanted to have a little bit of adventure outside of the known territory of Seattle. So we went to a small town called CELA, Washington. It was a town of 3,000. This is in the middle of the apple orchards. And I practiced law, and we raised alfalfa. I may be the only alfalfa grower in the presidential race. We'll have to check on this. And enjoyed it. It was a great experience, and I loved the community, but it was very, very red, conservative Republican area. And so I won two legislative races and then won a congressional race in a huge upset in central Washington. And then in 1994, a bill came up to ban assault weapons. And I knew that if I voted to ban assault weapons, I would be relieved of duty by the voters.
Because you were a member of Congress from a district that was largely rural.
Very rural.
And pretty pro-gun.
And 60-65% Republican. So,
and so you were winning. How many terms did you serve there?
Just one term there in that district, congressional term. I had two state legislative terms.
Okay.
So I voted for the assault weapon bill, knowing that I would lose in the next election. And both of those things happened. But I just want to tell you, I've never regretted that vote. I've always thought that was the right vote, never regretted it.
You got beat by a Republican challenger?
By a challenger. A guy had beat the previous term in 1992. And then we moved back to the Seattle area, and then I went back to Congress in 1998, having defeated an incumbent Republican, one of only two defeated that year. And I was back in a different congressional district. So I have a very
wild. So in Seattle metro area.
Correct.
What did you learn from that defeat in 94?
That a defeat is very, very painful.
Personally?
You know, personally. It hurts. You know, it hurts. It stings. I know this sounds weird, but I enjoyed being in Congress. I thought I was really doing good work. I helped get our apples into Japan. I got a water bill through that saved the agricultural industry in central Washington to some degree. So I had really great success as a new member of Congress. And I'd moved my family 2,500 miles and had our kids in public school in D.C. And so it's painful.
Oh, the kids came out.
Kids came out.
Oof.
But and here's the other part, though, that I I'm very sincere about this. I never regretted the loss because it was based on a vote of principle. It was something that I do believe had a capacity and did save lives over time while it was in place. It did help move the gun safety needle forward to some degree. And my vote was one of the pivotal votes. When Chuck Schumer called me, they were only three votes short. So I cast one of the pivotal votes to actually get it through. So what I learned is that when you do things out of principle, you will not regret them. And life will go on. And if you're lucky and persistent and the ball bounces your way, you may be back in public life at some point.
Although it's kind of a fascinating story about – I mean your trajectory here is a really interesting story about the kind of – dynamics of spatial partisan polarization that's happened in the country, right?
Yeah,
because like you're a Seattle guy,
mm-hmm.
and you go out, you move to this rural district. It's a conservative district, mm-hmm. but you're able to get elected. Mm-hmm. And then you're basically blown up over a thing where you don't agree with your constituents. I mean, at some level, they're kind of right to vote you out if they care about.
They certainly have that right.
I mean, and then – but then you go back to Metro Seattle and you're elected there. Mm-hmm. And how many terms do you serve there?
Well, I bet I gave up counting at 7, I think, and then went to the governor's office in 2012. By the way, I left something out. I lost a primary for the governorship in 1996 as well. I have a War and Peace type of novel right. about my political history. It is, and this polarization of the country is very challenging to us who do serve in public life.
Yeah, like you couldn't – there's no way Jay Inslee now could win that out in Eastern Washington where you started.
Well, I never say no, but there
you
are
You didn't
some
win
things...
that district in your gubernatorial
races. I didn't in 1994.
Races.
Did not win in the governor's races, but did better than most candidates.
Sure, overperformed. But I'm just saying, my point being that it's like, I feel like there's two things that are happening and it's hard to get your head around it. Mm-hmm. One is that you don't want to give up on people and places. People, right. everyone deserves representation. They deserve mm-hmm. your open heart and mind, right?
Right?
As a journalist, as a politician. But it's also the case that like certain parts of the country are just super conservative. That's their beliefs and their values.
Right. But I will say two points about that. Number one, you do have an obligation and desire to know them, to
yeah,
converse with them.
100%.
To be open to them, to serve their needs.
To listen to them.
And to listen to them. That's very important. But electorally, you should not give up on these communities either. Because frankly, and I'm just going to speak electorally, one of the secrets of success is to do, you know, 4 or 5 points better in small towns in the Midwest to get elected.
100%,
and
yes.
it is entirely possible to do that. I proved that in my electorals. I won 3 out of 4 elections in a very Republican area. I know I feel very much at home in small towns. I'm a guy who, you know, did hang with farmers and orchardists and did grow alfalfa and now have a message of clean energy jobs growth, which really works in small town America. Building electric cars in relatively small towns in Michigan, putting up wind turbines in rural Iowa, making carbon fiber in Moses Lake to go in electric cars, a small town in eastern Washington, doing biofuels in Grays Harbor, which is a small town in western Washington on the coastline. So I have messages that I think can help us perform better if I end up being the nominee in small town America around job creation. And we proved this in the last election cycle when I was chair of the DJ and we won 7 governor's races because we did have people talking about meat and potato jobs issues. They did do better in small towns than in the previous electoral cycle because we did converse with these communities.
That point's a really important one, which is we end up thinking in these binary terms, but the margins are everything. You know, I mean, Sherrod Brown's a U.S. senator because, sure, he gets huge amounts of votes from Columbus and Cleveland,
right.
but he does better in, you know, his margins are better
That's
than,
correct.
Say, Hillary Clinton or
That's
another
correct.
Statewide Democrat in places that are outside those big metros. He doesn't win them.
That's correct.
He just does a little bit better.
You just do a little bit better, and that's how you win. Now, here's also an important fallacy to point out. I think some people feel that it is inconsistent to want to do better by 3 or 4 points in small-town America and also purvey the progressive values that I've advanced in the state of Washington. I've been the first governor who spoke against the Muslim ban, having done the first net neutrality, having the best gender pay equity in the United States, having passed the first public option in the United States. So we've done all of these progressive things in my state, and advancing those causes is not inconsistent with doing better in small towns while you talk about job creation at all.
So you've been governor since 2012.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start to get, for lack of a better word, religion on climate?
Well, I've been a convert. And let me push back just a little bit about the religion issue because it is not a religious conviction. It
yeah.
is a scientific validity. And I think that's an important thing. I know you're just kind of teasing when you say it that way.
Yeah,
but
right.
But it is a point. If tomorrow the scientific consensus changed, I'd change my heartbeat. If tomorrow somebody could prove the climate crisis was a hoax and a myth, boom.
That would be awesome. I see people say this all the time, I think. Or I see people say, you know, science is going to figure it out or maybe we're wrong. And I think, good God, nothing I hope for more fervently than that we are wrong about all this. Please let us be wrong.
I would be ecstatic to be able to just celebrate the World Cup women's win and quit worrying about the climate
yeah.
crisis. Okay, that would be great.
Same.
But I have been very much following the science since, well, in 1992 when I ran for Congress, Trudy pulled out one of my old campaign brochures and I had in there that we have to fight carbon dioxide. That was since 1992. I then became active with a group in the mid-1990s hanging around the University of Washington on this subject and then beat a Republican in 1998 on environmental issues and was very active in Congress, introduced legislation in the early 2000s, wrote a book about this in 12 years ago. Right, I co-authored a book on this subject. So why am I so passionate about this? Two things. One, I'm the son of a biology teacher and I just follow science. I think you got to be led by science. And people who argue with me about this or want to argue with me about it say, look, you're not arguing with me. You got to argue about with the scientific community. You got to argue with Sir Isaac Newton and, Einstein. Those are the guys you got to go argue with. So I've been at that scientific assertion for a long, long time. But now it is a very personal thing with me. And several months ago when I was thinking about running for president, that's something you think seriously about, obviously, because I love being governor. I've been very successful and got a great thing going in our state. But I just really want to be able to look at my three grandkids on my last day, literally, and tell them, look, I did everything I could possibly do to save you from the climate crisis. But so I'm running for president.
Do you feel like that's true about your governorship?
In what way? What do you mean?
Can you say you've done everything you could possibly do on carbon emissions and the climate for the state?
Yes.
And have you reduced emissions?
They are going to go down under our new rules. They have gone up while I've been governor because we have had economic growth and population growth.
But this is the thing to me. It's like – and I'm not saying this to at all doubt your sincerity at all. When I'm in my darkest places about this problem, I think to myself, well, all right, Jay Inslee. Yeah, good for Jay Inslee. Yeah, he's running on climate. And it's like, what's he doing as governor? He's like, well, he's doing some good stuff, but he had Republican opposition. He didn't have unified control. What are emissions in his state? Oh, they're going up. It's like if Jay Inslee's state's emissions are going up under Jay Inslee's leadership, we're screwed.
So, Chris, I want you to be able to get up every morning and not be clinically depressed. So I'm going to give you some really good news here, okay? If you've got to accept some good news, the cavalry has arrived. So we won 10 seats in the state legislature. As a result of that—
In 2018.
In 2018. Right. So as a result, we had a Democratic Senate for the first time.
So you became—just to be clear— You had a Republican Senate starting in 2012.
Right.
You had a Republican Senate.
Correct.
And then in 2018, you turned over to what people call trifecta, right? So unified Democratic governance,
correct.
Governor,
correct.
House,
so,
Senate.
So as a result of that, we have now passed bills that are about 80% of what I have asked to pass. We've passed the country's best 100% clean electrical grid bill that will require fossil fuel grid and a carbon neutral grid by 2035. Best in the country because it also embraces very strong environmental justice provisions to make sure that the jobs we create are well-paid union jobs, to make sure that we focus on the frontline communities that have been the first victims of the climate change crisis. We passed the country's best energy efficiency program that is the first in the nation that will require retrofitting for our commercial buildings so that we can have much more energy efficiency. And today I visited a union training program with SEIU where they train building superintendents about how to wring efficiency out of your buildings. And you can get enormous efficiencies tuning your boiler, putting in energy efficient lights and the like. We passed a ban on super pollutants. We reinvigorated our incentive program to help people get access to electric cars. So I'm very confident that these measures will result in reductions of emissions.
And through periods of population and economic growth.
Yes, and they are very strong.
You don't have a cap.
We do not have a cap yet. Take this back. We do have a cap if I win a case in my state Supreme Court in the next couple of months. So I actually imposed a cap, which was the first actual cap created by executive order in the country. A trial court made a small mistake and invalidated it, and that is now on appeal in my state Supreme Court. So if that is affirmed, we will have the most binding cap on carbon in the United States.
And that will say this is the limit for
our
state.
That's correct.
This
every industry over a certain level of emissions will be required to reduce their emissions of a certain percentage over time. It will be the strongest carbon emission reduction program in the United States. I am hopeful that I will prevail in the state Supreme Court. There's good reason to believe we will. My AG says we're on very good ground, so I hope that that will happen. If that does not happen, we'll be back to the legislature next session. we need one or two votes to pass what I'd proposed, which is a clean fuel standard for transportation. That's the one part where we've – the piece of the puzzle we've got to fix in Washington.
Do you have a renewable portfolio standard for the state?
We do, and we passed it by initiative. I was very active in that 10 years ago.
Right.
And
so that's been there for a while.
That's correct. It's been incredibly successful.
If people just don't know, the renewable portfolio standard is probably at the state level the single most – one of the most effective – means of reduction,
yeah,
and particularly in terms of seeding vibrant alternative energy markets. And also there's one – there's actually quite a very good one in Texas. There's a pretty good one in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something that has been solely the purview of like Democratic-controlled states. It's actually fairly popular and been done all over the country.
They've been very successful. And when we brought it to the people in the initiative – the energy companies, you know, scream that this is going to blow up your utility bills. And it simply has not happened. We've created a $6 billion wind industry in the state of Washington. And the same thing is happening in Iowa. Almost 30%. They've got about 30% of their electricity in Iowa coming from wind now.
And just to explain to folks, that the standard basically requires that a certain percentage for the utilities, a certain percentage of their power has to come from non-fossil fuel sources.
Correct. And so far, all of them have been successful across the United States, including in Texas, as you indicated. And so I would recommend it to everyone, but we've just got to ramp that up. Now, we've extended that, if you will, to 100% in our 100% electrical grid bill that just passed.
And so explain that. What does that mean?
It basically means that we, by law, we have a regulatory requirement that utilities will be carbon neutral by 2035. That means that their emissions have to be neutral if you look at their entire portfolio. And they have to be fossil-free by 2045. That means that we will not be burning fossil fuels to produce electricity at the last date by 2045. And this is a binding law. It is not a hope. It is not a wish. It is not a dream. It is binding. And I point this out because I think some folks, including some running for president, have sort of wanted to sneak through this thing saying we're going to have some system in 2050, it'll do good things. But you need more than that. You really need binding requirements that have been so useful to us in our environmental work over the last two decades.
I wanted to sort of talk about the politics of this for a second. There was a ballot initiative also in 2018,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Explain to me what that was.
So there was an initiative in 2018. It would have created a carbon fee or tax, depending on who you listen to.
I can imagine what the proponents called it and what the opponents called it.
The opponents spent $32 million, and some of it was information that was not entirely credible. But when you have $32 million with the fossil fuel industry behind it, the oil and gas industry, and they created some doubt in the voters' minds about some of the technical parts of the program, and it went down to defeat rather decisively. So we were undaunted by that because we knew, A, climate change was getting worse anyway. B, we were convinced that we could create jobs in our state. So I introduced five bills that would, as a package, achieve the same level of carbon reduction.
This is a little wonky, but let's go there for a second. So the policy problem is carbon emissions keep going up.
Mm-hmm.
Carbon pollution is the thing that's warming the atmosphere. We need to start zeroing out our carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And the policy solution for a long time has been either cap and trade or cap and dividend. And basically the idea is you put a cap on carbon and then companies trade for carbon credits. That's what happens in cap and trade. Or you put a tax on carbon, a carbon tax, like, you know, cigarette tax or something. That money then goes into general revenue where people get it in their households. But the entire idea behind it – I'm just doing this for folks that are not familiar with this – is that you put a price on carbon, right? So the idea is that carbon pollution is an externality in the sense – in economics terminology. It's a thing that costs all of us, but the people producing it don't have to pay the cost.
Right.
And that's like polluting the river, right? It's much cheaper to pollute in the river and let someone else clean it up, but that's an externality. So for a long time, as long as I've been covering carbon, that's the central thing. Price on carbon, price the externality. That's a tough political sell. Do you agree?
Through experience, clearly, because I was very, very active.
You wanted that thing passed.
Very, very active trying to pass a cap and trade bill back in 2009 in the U.S. House. And it passed the U.S. House. And then the Obama administration decided to move forward on healthcare rather than climate. So healthcare happened, climate did not. And I believe that a price on carbon is an elegant solution. In my plan, we actually propose a price on carbon starting with the industrial sector. But I have come to conclude two very important things. Number one, we don't have time to just let the elegance of a price be the only measure of success here. We just do not have time. The science has been clear that we have to get off coal in 10 years. We have to get off natural gas in 15 years in the electrical grid, and we have no other option. The science has made this clear. And the most effective and the only politically tenable route to do that is through a regulatory system. Now, we know this works. You go back to the early 70s where the smog was so bad you couldn't see Mount Rainier from Seattle, right? And we decided instead of using the elegant means of a price on catalytic converters, we passed a law saying you will put catalytic converters on our cars. And the auto industry squawked, but they did it, and the air cleaned up.
Right.
And we have to follow that success story again with the regulatory system.
Old-fashioned hammer regulation mandates.
This mandate is required by science, and it is required by politics. And I'll tell you why. Because it is impossible, I believe, to pass a pricing system today that would achieve the same regulatory approach at the levels of the price that would be required.
What's interesting about it, too, is that I feel like actually the politics of it maybe are better. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this. And if you say we're going to put a price on carbon, people recognize that they pay for energy. Like that you're like, I pay for carbon. When I put my lights on, when I fill up my car, like I'm aware of that. Everyone's aware of that. If you say, well, we got to price that, it's like, well, I buy that. So I'm going to pay for that. If you say we have to mandate those people over there, industry, utilities, the fossil fuel companies, that actually seems like an easier sell to me.
By 1,000%. And that's one of the reasons I'm proposing it. And we've had success, as I've indicated. We passed four measures that are the best in the United States on this.
I mean, the argument, of course, the fossil fuel companies will make is like, that's just the wording, but you're going to end up paying one way or the other. Right?
That's
what they say.
Yes, that's what they say.
And not completely baselessly.
But in a sense, not. That's not really true, though, because we went through this renewable portfolio standard. They said utility rates were going to skyrocket.
Right.
Now, what has happened because of the genius of the American economy and the genius of the American people, in virtually every environmental regulatory system that we have enacted, the market has responded with technological changes that essentially have no additional costs because they've driven investments,
right.
They've driven R&D, the market has responded to bring these new technologies on at no cost. When people said we were going to go to wind and solar, they said, oh, it'll cost you 10 times as much. Well, the market responded. Cost for solar panels have come down 80% in the last 10 years. Cost of wind has come down 20%. And as a result, clean energy jobs are growing twice as fast as the U.S. economy. So we understate how flexible technology is repeatedly.
I completely agree with that. And in fact, I think one of the great examples of this is cell phones in the developing world in the global south, where in the developed countries you had landlines and then you had cell phones. Throughout the global south, right, they never got the landlines, but they just went right to the cell phone.
You skip a generation. And anybody who doubts the technological arc of electric cars, look at the arc of cell phones in your own life. Look how fast they've come on to become ubiquitous. We have the same opportunity today in electrifying the transportation system and going to a renewable system in the grid. And I believe that that is happening before our eyes. And I see it in real terms. This is not an abstraction for me. So I mentioned this Moses Lake, Washington, a small town in eastern Washington, used to represent it. It is the largest manufacturer of carbon fiber that goes into the bodies of carbon fiber electric cars right now. And it's in a small town in eastern Washington, put hundreds of people to work. This is not like a dream or hallucination or a chart on somebody's graph. It's actually happening all across the country.
I want to circle back again to the politics of this issue. And then I want to talk about your presidential run right after this.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
So you've had some successes and you've had some defeats. I mean, you worked on the Waxman-Markey cap and trade bill when you were in the House. You've passed these very sort of forward-leaning policies as governor, or signed them into law. You dealt a defeat on the ballot initiative. There's this crazy story that happened in your neighboring state over climate legislation, mm-hmm. in which the Republicans just left the state and sort of kind of implicitly intimated that maybe armed militias would rally around them to protect them from, like, the governor bringing them back, and then won the standoff. Like, the Democrats abandoned the climate bill in the face of the intransigence.
Yeah. What the story I heard is they simply did not have votes ultimately in the Democratic Party.
In the Democratic Party, right.
So that,
although I don't think it helped. I mean, the resistance seems to have helped.
We were looking for a way to take those errant legislators into custody if they were on my side of the border, but we didn't find we had authority to do it. So we had to resolve it in other ways. Look, here is one thing I've learned. You ask about a lesson in this, is that I have had a discovery about renewable energy, and that is that the most powerful, the most important renewable energy is the power of perseverance. We just have to persevere. Failure is not an option here. You know, Churchill said that when people said, well, you should treat with Hitler. You know, England cannot stand alone. And he said, no, victory is the only option, because without victory, there's no survival. This is the same situation here. So, yes, we have had multiple defeats. We'll probably have some more defeats. But we're gonna win them because there is no other option.
But I want you to talk about what the nature of the resistance is, because I think there's an interesting thing that happens. So there's embedded industrial interests that have a lot of money on the line, the fossil fuel companies. Mm-hmm. But there's also the nature of political opposition, the culture of conservatism and opposition, where it can become a kind of almost culture war issue. Like, you're coming from my way of life. And you see this now with the way Fox News talks about the Green New Deal. They're going to take your burgers. They're going to take your car. Like, they these like pointy-headed, remote, liberal weirdos are going to tell you, hardworking middle American, like, how you can live. And there's a kind of a potency to that. I just think, on what terrain do you fight that? How do you see that political rhetorical battle?
It's a losing battle for Donald Trump. And the reason I know it's a losing battle is he essentially told us this 2 days ago.
Yeah, I had the exact same read on it.
Because he went out there and his pundits and his team said, look, we're in deep trouble, boss. Your approval rating on environment is 29%. You have to bring up that approval rating because you're getting killed in broad swaths of America on this issue. So he went out there and tried to – the farcical effort to try to say he was an environmentalist. Who would do that unless in an act of great desperation? They are losing this battle. And I believe it is the very weakest place or chink in the armor of Donald Trump, because it's the weakest part of his entire portfolio, and that we would be wise – to nominate the strongest nominee we can on this issue. And it won't shock you who I would nominate for that. So I believe they are losing this battle. And the reason they're losing this battle, and I recognize what you're saying, this is exactly what they say, is because people are now seeing this in their real lives. When I wrote a book or co-authored a book 12 years ago about this, this was just a chart on a graph. It was just a line of parts per million going up the chart. Now it's Paradise, California, burned to the ground. And it's Davenport, Iowa, underwater. And it's the Miami waterfront inundated. And it's 3.3 inches of rain in Washington, D.C. And now New Orleans underwater. My nephew couldn't get out of his hotel the other day because of the rain in New Orleans.
I have the same sense. When you go – and one of the things you've been doing in campaigning is going to these sort of frontline areas that have sort of suffered through climate disasters. Mm-hmm. I can never tell, because it's a little self-selecting, like, whether people are putting that together or not.
The answer is they are. Of their own common sense. And the objective evidence of this is that in the last 12 months, the polling on this has moved 12 points. That is a dramatic shift. And so it is clear that the American people are. And there is a very distinct difference between Republican citizens and Republican politicians. About half of registered Republican voters, when you ask them, is climate change a problem? Should we do something about it? They will say yes. But virtually zero of the Republican politicians will say that. Why? Because they're all captured by the fossil fuel industry, and they are afraid of the combination of getting cut off by the fossil fuel industry and worried about a primary for Donald Trump. They're worried about the shadow of Donald Trump.
I tend to think, in my analysis, it's almost the latter that matters more.
Yeah, it may be true.
They could probably find some replacement money, the thing that scares the hell out of them.
That may be true. And so you are seeing a rapid shift on this in the American public, including vast numbers of Republican voters. But they are not getting representation. And we dream and hope for the emergence of Teddy Roosevelt's spirit again. I keep looking forward to that. It has not emerged yet. We really don't have any partners yet. We hope that they will emerge. And until they emerge, they just have to be removed from office. And that is happening. Look, we won 7 governorships. I was chair of the Democratic governors last year. We got 7 new Democratic governors, in part all of whom who believe climate change was a problem we should deal with. We had 40 new members of Congress. We had 10 new legislators in my state. I do believe the American public understands this now. They are making that connection. And people have asked, you know, what could I do to convince them? I'm not convincing them. The facts are convincing them. The images of Oprah's house under a mudslide in Paradise, California burned to the ground, that's what's convincing them. So I think we're reaching a tipping point. And I look at this as the cresting of 2 waves that are at the same moment. The urgency wave, the pinnacle of recognition of the urgency of this, is happening at the same moment that the potential of economic growth and job creation is cresting as well. So it's a magic moment. We just need a leader, in my book, to spark that.
So you're running for president of the United States. You're one of, depending on how you count, 25, 24 Democrats who are running. You were in the first debate. You'll qualify, I think, for the second, right?
Yeah, we'll be in Detroit, yes.
Yeah, you'll be in Detroit. I want you to respond to the most cynical interpretation of your run here, which is basically like, it's an extremely crowded field. You're a, you know, very accomplished politician. You served in different levels of government. You've been a 2-term governor. There's a time in my life, particularly I think back in the 1990s, particularly, where when you were thinking about presidential candidates, it was all like, who are the governors? That was always the crop that you chose from, particularly because of the success of then, you know, Reagan, Carter, Clinton, all governors. Mm-hmm. That's less the case now, I think, because Barack Obama and Donald Trump have very different backgrounds. Basically, you and your team looked out there and it's like, how can I get traction? How can I carve out my lane? What's my branding, essentially, to distinguish me from other people? I'm going to be the climate guy as a kind of marketing choice in this field.
Well, that would not be an accurate depiction of the situation. And the best evidence of that is, look, I have lived these battles for decades. This is at the core of who I am. And I have spent a substantial amount of my professional life fighting this battle on multiple occasions as a member of Congress, as a person out of office. I started this when I was out of office, actually, this effort in the middle 1990s with a group in Seattle. I've helped form the U.S. Climate Alliance with Governor Jerry Brown and Governor Cuomo, which has been very effective, by the way, because we now have 24 states that are committed to the Paris Agreement. And we did that because we wanted to show the rest of the world that there was intelligent life in this country. I introduced some of the earliest climate legislation in the early 2000s in this regard. And anyone who knows me, that I can be a little bit insufferable on this subject in private life over a beer as well. So the fact of the matter, this is very close to who I am as an individual. And as I've indicated to you, this is the thing that tipped me over to run for president. I mean, I literally looked at my grandkids and I realized they are going to have very degraded lives unless something changes. The world depends on United States leadership. The United States will not be able to lead unless it has presidential leadership. And we will not have that presidential leadership, I am convinced, unless we elect a person who understands this has to be the top priority of the United States. And I fundamentally believe this, and I think this distinguishes me from the rest of the candidates, because if this is not job one, it will not get done. I saw this movie in 2009 where we decided to do something other than climate change. There's only enough oxygen in the congressional system to do something gigantic like this, and I believe it has to be this first.
Okay. This gets to a related set of issues. There's lots of stuff. There's lots of fires to put out.
Yes.
I mean, I cover, you know, I do an hour of news every night, right? Mm-hmm. So my feeling about the priorities before human civilization right now align with yours, and I think align with other people, which is that the climate is a civilizational struggle, a once in human life on the planet struggle, World War II level kind of thing.
Yes.
But like, do I cover it that like that? I'm not sure. I mean, because there's a lot of other news. And when I see child separation and the structural impediments that they're trying to put a census question and the growth of inequality and the level of corruption, it's just – it is hard. You know, there's a lot of stuff to talk about. And I just think like particularly how do you think about that? And particularly how do you think about that with a Democratic Party coalition that is diverse, that is heterogeneous, mm-hmm. that has people who are have family members facing deportation, mm-hmm. incarceration, extreme economic misery,
mm-hmm.
health care holes? Like there's a lot of people with a lot of issues who are like, yeah, the climate's important, but I got some other stuff I got to deal with.
Well, here's some really good news for you. What I have found is if you have strong, resilient, smart executive leadership, you can address all of those things while you're addressing the climate change crisis, as we had in the state of Washington. So
wait a second. I just want to point out that that's a little bit in tension with what you just said, right? Because what you just said 2 minutes ago, which I agree with, is mm-hmm. you get one window in Congress for one big thing, mm-hmm. right? So if that big thing is climate, it's not comprehensive immigration reform. Like there's a time for choosing that's going to happen. And you and I both know that like let's say you get a unified government, you get one big domestic bill. My understanding from you, and I would agree with you, and it's what I would do if I were elected president, right. is you move on climate. But that means that those 11 million who are undocumented aren't getting legalized.
So let me push back on your assumption. We have experience on this in Washington State. We have been very vigorous on clean energy, as we've talked about. We've had tremendous advances on clean energy. Simultaneously, we have been the first governor to stand up against the Muslim ban. We have been now beat Donald Trump 22 times in court, and one of which is the child separation issue. We have passed the very first public option on health care in the United States. We have passed the most robust, comprehensive, and rich program for free college tuition for low-income people. We have passed the best gender pay equity bill in the United States. We have passed the first net neutrality statute in the United States, which I have signed. I have tackled the racial disparity issue that is so prevalent in our society by issuing pardons and offering pardons to thousands of people in the drug wars. We've now reinstituted affirmative action. We've got rid of the death penalty. What I'm depicting to you is in a prioritization array, you can do many of these things as well. But I stick by my statement that ultimately you got to start with the biggest problem, and this is the biggest problem.
If you were to get a table together mm-hmm. of various institutional players and stakeholders that represent various different constituencies mm-hmm. throughout what is broadly the center left or a sort of anti-Trump coalition.
Mm-hmm.
My sense, my read on this as a reporter is that there's not consensus that climate's the number one issue, although it's moving in that direction.
I think this is a rapidly changing dynamic, including in the Democratic Party. If you look at the polling results in the Democratic Party, it also has changed dramatically in the double digits in the last year or two. So it is now listed as the number one priority in Iowa and Nevada and New Hampshire, sometimes tied with healthcare in this regard. This is a rapidly changing issue. And again, Democrats are now seeing this affecting their families. I mean, I think of a woman named Regina Haddock. I met her. She ran a nonprofit in Davenport, Iowa called Dress for Success. And they help women who are victims of domestic violence and women who needed a little hand up in life. And they were in operation for 10 years. They served about 1,500 women a year. And then here comes the flood, unprecedented flood, never seen floods like this before. Hamburg, Iowa, founded in 1858, never flooded since 1858, now under 8-9 feet of water. So here comes the flood, washes away her nonprofit. She's out of luck, had no insurance, lost her lease. And now there's 1,500 women out of luck. This is a, quote, progressive liberal issue that we Democrats care about. We have deep compassion in my party. And this is now cutting the heart out of what we hold dear, which is our families. And so this is becoming a top drawer issue in the Democratic Party. And I believe it's sort of like, Wayne Gretzky said, you always want to skate to where the puck's going to be. Mm-hmm. It's going to be even more intense in the next 2 years because these tragedies are going to get more frequent and more intense. The scientific community is pulling their hair out right now about what they're seeing. They're seeing the permafrost melt in the Arctic, which holds gigatons of methane. And methane is a runaway potential greenhouse gas. They're seeing unprecedented.
Multiples worse than carbon.
Multiple,
in terms of what it
20,
does.
15, 30 times worse per molecule. You're seeing temperatures in Europe. You're seeing temperatures in India that, in a sense, make places almost uninhabitable. So I think you're seeing a very rapid change in the political context, but it's like anything. You need a spark. And I've lived through presidential leadership and seeing John F. Kennedy. I saw that, you know, with my own eyes. We're going to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the landing on the moon. And I believe presidential leadership is capable of igniting this country to do what we did, not just in the space race, but what we did in World War II. Because that's what we have to do. The scale of mobilization that is necessary is similar to World War II. And for those who say we can't do this, baloney. For those who say we can't start building electric cars in 10 years, baloney. In 1940, we built 70 Jeeps. The entire industrial capacity built 70 Jeeps in 1940. By 1945, we had built 640,000 Jeeps. That's what the U.S. economy is capable of doing once we set it on a demand curve to get that job done. And we have to do that. Who says that? Isaac Newton, the people who are the scientific community telling us this.
My favorite factoid about the Jeep is that the reason the panels are square is because they requisitioned washing machine factories to make them.
Panels?
Yeah, that's why they have no – so the machinery that they used to produce Jeeps had been used to make washing machines. Yeah. They had square panels, so they had no curves, which is why the Jeep is boxy.
Well, people, if you're interested in this, I just got done reading a book called Freedom's Forge, and it was about how the industrial might of the U.S. was remobilized for this separate purpose. And I believe it is a template for what we need to achieve right now, and I believe that we can. And when we do this, millions of people are going to get jobs. You know, World War II was the greatest job-creating opportunity in American history. And this is going to create millions of jobs, and not just physicists, it's carpenters and laborers. Today, I mentioned that I went to a training program for building superintendents. And the retrofitting that we will need to do in our buildings will be an infrastructure program rivaling the interstate freeway system. Because all of these buildings, they were not built for energy efficiency over the last 100 years. We need to retrofit them. This is an enormous construction project for the building trades. So one of the things I think sometimes people think clean energy, they just think just solar panels. It's not just solar panels. It's carpenters, laborers, IBWs, plumbers that are going to do this work.
So I want to just come back to this climate debate question because it's something you've been pushing for, a climate center debate.
Yes.
The DNC has said, look, we gave the rules. We're not doing special topic debates. I think if I were them, I would probably say the same thing, because if I were managing the coalition, then I would have to turn around and say, like, should we have a racial justice debate? Probably. Should we have a labor debate? Probably. Like, I think that's the argument basically, that if you open this door, then – a whole bunch of other people are going to say, look, this is a pressing issue. We should have a devoted debate on it. What do you say to that?
Two things. Number one, this is the issue that threatens life on the planet Earth. It is difficult to say that this is not distinguished from other issues. Our survival literally depends on this issue.
I would say nuclear nonproliferation might be in the same category. But just
possibly. So there is a difference between this issue and others, number one. Number two, if you're not going to hold a separate debate, at least allow the candidates to go hold their own debate. And essentially, the party has blacklisted candidates who will go have their own debate on this subject. And that's just nuts to have some kind of blacklist to say Democrats can't go out and debate something that presents an existential crisis. The third thing I would say is, look, it may not be bad to have multiple debates on separate subjects. It's more productive.
See, I think that's
More productive.
I think that's the smarter rhetorical move. Like, you think, well, wait, maybe an immigration debate would be good. I mean, I feel like you could learn a lot from an immigration
listen,
debate.
Listen, here's the problem. The party right now is going to have 12 debates. Each subject's going to have 60 to 120 seconds divided. Right. You're going to get bumper sticker answers from all the candidates, and you're never going to be able to drill down and really understand where the candidates are. So it might be a better way to do it. But what I'm saying is we ought to have a debate on this subject. It is unique. It is now also, I think, important to the party that, look, there's only one party that has the possibility of saving humanity here. It's the Democratic Party. And it would be a good thing to brand our party party who cares about this.
It's so sad that that is like a not hyperbolic statement.
I wish, I wish it were otherwise.
It sounds so ridiculous. It sounds so inflated to say, well, there's two parties and there's only one party that could save humanity. But it's like, Sadly, that's kind of where we're at right now.
There is a sad scientific reality that this is required, and there is a sad political reality that there's only one party offering solutions. Or at least the politicians are not. The people are. The people understand this.
So let's say, okay, Jay Inslee wins the nomination. He becomes elected president of the United States with the crazy, you know, New Deal 1932 or 1964 style landslides. Effectively, like – super majorities in both houses.
You heard it first right here in the Chris A. show.
So let's imagine that's the case. Basically, give me the program, like in a short, a relatively concise, like you put out two big documents on climate plans, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
But give me the citizen-friendly version of the Jay Inslee presidential climate plan.
We are going to mobilize the incredible talents and resources of the United States to build a clean energy economy. We are going to put 8 million people to work while we do that in good union-paid jobs. We're going to do this by using known, very high-confidence things that we know actually work to accomplish that. Some of that would involve executive action to use the existing statutory authority of the executive branch to adopt regulations that will require companies to give us cleaner energy. Some would involve further legislation that would also involve requiring industries to give us clean energy. Some of it would involve some pricing mechanism, particularly with industrial polluters that are harder to deal with a regulatory standpoint. Some of it would involve research and development to help use our research labs to continue the research that we need to do. Some would involve infrastructure investments where we have to rebuild our housing and commercial housing stock. Some of it would involve infrastructure in our transportation system. We have to rebuild the economy that is not based on fossil fuels. In the next 50 years, unless we wean ourselves off of gasoline, diesel, and coal, and natural gas, the Earth will become virtually uninhabitable. And that's just a scientific reality. So we need to have exercise the powers of imagination of the most creative, innovative, inventive people in human history, and that's the American people. And I'm very confident we can do this because we've done this in multiple occasions. That's as much as I can boil it down.
Yeah. So there's a few different channels. There's legislation. There is a price. There's on the, mm-hmm. the sort of industrial sector. Mm-hmm. There's research and development. There's sort of green jobs programs and mm-hmm. retrofitting and infrastructure. There are caps, right? I mean, there's going to be
– there's legitimate caps.
Like requirements. Like
that's exactly
– we can't pollute above this
correct.
Level.
Correct.
And forcing – a kind of forcing mechanism of a very strong, clear market signal to everyone distributed out through the system who's making everything from cars to industrial machinery
right.
that this is the way it's going to be.
So look, we know these things work. When we told – as a people, we told the auto industry to give us cars with catalytic – converters. They squawked, but they did it. And as a result, we have clean air.
Well, it's
spectacularly safe cars now as a result of federal mandates.
Even emission standards.
And emission standards.
I was looking – I've been thinking – I have three kids and we have a hybrid Toyota Highlander and we spilled milk in the back seat. And
that is terrible.
It is the worst.
I'm sorry. You're going to sell the car.
This is literally – I know. This has been told. This is like my own version of getting off carbon is that the challenge in my household is getting the smell of sour milk out of a car.
You're done.
And I've been told this. By the way, I have – that's to my own horn.
Do not buy a used car from this man. I will tell you
right now. Exactly. I'm screwing up my chances. No, I think I've successfully purged the smell from the car after multiple rounds of things like coffee. It's insane. Point being, at one point I was like, well, maybe we got three kids. They're going to get bigger. It's time to move up to a minivan, but I don't want to buy a car that's a huge gas guzzler. Mm-hmm. And I was pleasantly surprised to see what the fuel efficiency is on newly produced minivans because of the fuel efficiency standards.
Right.
Have pretty good fuel efficiency compared to, you know, a compact car 5 years ago.
So the regulatory changes, all of the things you just mentioned were ordered by Uncle Sam.
Yeah,
and the industry
right.
responded. And we are capable about doing this. Look, we have 50,000 electric cars on the road today in Washington State, in part because of our incentive program. In part, we've built electrical charging stations. We need now to basically tell the auto industry to give us cleaner cars, as we have done on multiple occasions. This time, they have to be fossil-free free. And I'm proposing that we tell the industry to start giving us clean cars 10 years from now. That is an entirely achievable goal. we've got at least 40 new electric car models coming online today, even without a mandate.
Yeah.
The battery technology is moving very, very rapidly in this regard. These are achievable results, but we need a signal to the industry to produce, and that is the job of Uncle Sam.
All right. So here's the final question. I don't know if you followed this, but there's a coal mine in Wyoming. A lot of coal production moved from the East Coast to Wyoming in the last 10, 15 mm-hmm. years. Coal has become largely uneconomic. Mm-hmm. It's really mostly a market story about why it's dying more than a regulatory story. Mm-hmm. But there's a big – I think one or two coal mines in Wyoming that have shuttered now. State Republicans – tried some kind of crazy stuff to save it, essentially create these state subsidies for an uneconomic coal mm-hmm. plant, which is just totally nuts.
Right.
But it's shuttering now, and there's about 200 coal miners are going to lose their mm-hmm. jobs. That to me is like where the rubber hits the road for your message, for Democrats' message, for everyone is. Mm-hmm. There are so many people who feel like I'm going to be left out of this transition. I'm already being left out of it. And you can say all you want to me, blue state governor, liberal congressman, whatever. I just don't believe you mm-hmm. that like you have my interests at heart, me, Wyoming coal miner. Mm-hmm. What do you say to that person?
Well, look, these coal families are some of the most dedicated, hardworking families in American history. They built the industrial might of the United States. They helped us win two wars. These are the families that deserve respect and compassion and consideration and also the truth. And they are not getting the truth from the president of the United States right now. He is lying to them repeatedly. He's telling them he's going to bring back coal, and that is simply not going to happen because coal is not competitive with other sources of energy. Two-thirds of the plants have shut down simply because it is no longer cost competitive. And another thing they deserve the truth on is we need now to stand up to their bosses who want to welch on their pension and health care requirements. And I can tell you a guy who loves bankruptcy, which is Donald Trump, who is standing with their bosses, who is going to help them not meet their pension and retirement and health obligations to these miners, number one. Number two, we have to help these communities through transition. Now, this is not just something I say rhetorically because we are actually doing it in my state. We are closing the last coal-fired electrical plant in my state. It's in a little town called Centralia, Washington. We didn't just shut that thing off. We created a package of $55 million a year to help that community do through that transition with not just training and education for the miners, but also job creation because they need jobs, right?
Yeah. Tell me to go learn how to code in my
– This is a way we want to help these communities actually build businesses that can support jobs. Now, a lot of these coal miners have skill sets that are transferable to clean energy because guess who's going to be rebuilding and retrofilling and doing the machinery work and the electrical work? These people are very talented.
It's all machine operation anyway. Coal mining is done through machine anyway. So it's like if you're someone who's spent years, you know, no one's in there with explosives and pickaxes anymore. Like these are people who handles very sophisticated, very dangerous machinery.
These are highly skilled people. Their skills are transferable to the new economy in new wind turbine technicians. They might need a little new training, but yes, these jobs can be available. So, but listen, this is not to downplay the concern during any transition. Look, when you have to make a transition in life, it is not comfortable. I want to downplay the discomfort that these communities have going through this transition. But I believe that's the right thing for the federal government to embrace them and help them through this transition that we know is inevitable. And it's happening. The jobs today are growing twice as fast in clean energy than the whole rest of the U.S. economy and several fold in the fossil fuel-based system. So if we want to talk to our children, I know every father and mother I know or want to tell their kids, I want you to go into a career that's growing, not one that's going to not exist 10 years from now. So I think it's the right message.
All right. Jay Inslee is the governor of Washington State, former member of Congress and currently running for president of the United States. Thanks so much for making time.
Yes. And I know it will not violate your principles when I tell you that if people go to jayinslee.com and send a dollar, they can make sure that I'll be on the debate stage and climate change will be in the debate come hell or high water.
All right,
debates 3 and 4.
Brendan McDonald, make sure to edit that out. Okay, thanks a lot.
Once again, my great thanks to Governor Jay Inslee, who I'm now recording the outro to this not knowing if we edited out the last part where he plugged his website. But you could get a link to his website on our website as well. He is the governor of Washington. He is a 2020 presidential candidate. He's also the author. He mentioned this. He's author of a book called Apollo's Fire, Igniting America's Clean Energy Economy, which is about the climate and clean energy, which he wrote 12 years ago. We'd love to hear your feedback. As always, you can email withpod@gmail.com. You could tweet us with the hashtag withpod. Like I said at the top of the show, we asked for your feedback on the intros. We got a ton of it. It was overwhelmingly pro-intro. So I live to serve. You like the takes? I serve up the takes. So we value your feedback. We absolutely love to hear from you. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.